Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, welcome to this seventh session of Stakeholder Forum's Countdown to the SDG Summit 2023 series of eight webinars in the run-up to the September 2023 SDG Summit and the 2024 Summit of the Future. With the support of experts in each of the first 16 SDGs, we have been reviewing two SDGs each month. We began in November 2022 and will conclude in June 2023 in a run-up to the July 2023 United Nations High-Level Political Forum on Sustainable Development. The series continues to explore where we are in SDG implementation and to identify transformative actions for change with an emphasis on strengthening the environmental dimension of the 2030 agenda. Today's focus will be on SDG 13 and 14, Climate Action and Life Below Water. It's been organized by Stakeholder Forum for a Sustainable Future in connection with our proposed 2023 platform, an instrument to support greater and more effective stakeholder participation in the SDG Summit 2023 during this review cycle of the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development during the 2023 United Nations High-Level Political Forum. I'm Charles Newhan, Chair of Stakeholder Forum for a Sustainable Future and your host today from New York. Now, I will take just a moment to share our screen so that you can see our guests and the agenda. And now that that has been done, I'll continue by introducing our speakers and other guests. I'm joined today from Ireland by our moderator, Dr. David Horan, assistant professor at Trinity Business School in Trinity College Dublin and a fellow of Stakeholder Forum, where he advises us on SDG partnerships and governance. As you can see from the screen, we have a panel of special guests who, with a diverse range of experiences and knowledge, will be introduced by David in the coming minutes. For those of you not familiar with Stakeholder Forum, it is an international, not-for-profit NGO and consultative status with the United Nations Department of Economic and Social Affairs, commonly known as ECOSOC, since 1996, accredited with the United Nations Environment Program since 2005, and holds observer status with the UNFCCC. SF has, for more than 25 years, been working to advance sustainable development at all levels. We seek to provide a bridge between those who have a stake in sustainable development and the international forums where decisions are made in their name. Now, a little bit of housekeeping before we have our first speaker. Please note that the webinar is being live streamed on YouTube, and a link to the recording will be posted on the Stakeholder Forum website soon after. As you will see, attendee cameras and microphones are muted and will remain so throughout the webinar. However, there will be an opportunity for questions from attendees near the end of the experts roundtable discussion, and those questions should be submitted in the Q&A section at the bottom of your screen, not in the chat section. The chat section is for you to communicate with each other, where you can post links to matters relevant to the website, pardon, to the webinar topic, and share contact details with each other if you wish to. We'll also save the chat, and we'll share that when we share the other documents later today. Now, you're welcome to scroll through the questions that go into the Q&A box and upvote them. And that is, vote for a question if you too would like to see that very issue addressed. That will help us focus on which to select, and so we can answer questions in the time that we have in an expedient manner. Now, an apologies in advance for not being able to answer all questions. We have over 800 people registered today, and we certainly hope to have a good turnout overall. So if we can't get to your questions, please forgive us. Now on to our speakers. We begin today with introductory comments from Jan Gustav Strandenäs. Jan Gustav, our first speaker, began working with the UN on environment and governance matters in the 1970s. He has been lecturing about the UN for nearly 50 years, worked for NGOs at the United Nations in New York during the Commission on Sustainable Development years, and has carried out multiple assignments for UNEP. Earlier in his career, Jan Gustav worked as a diplomat for Norway's Foreign Office in Botswana and Uganda, and later on, he directed a large aid and environment NGO in Norway for nearly two decades. He is a longtime member of the Stakeholder Forum Board of Directors and our senior advisor on governance. Jan Gustav's most recent achievement was as the project manager for the Towards Stockholm Plus 50 project, a joint initiative by Stakeholder Forum for a Sustainable Future and the Norwegian Forum for Development and Environment. Jan Gustav, I'll now hand the floor over to you.
Thank you very much, Charles, and thank you for introducing me. And as we are wont to say with these webinars, good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, wherever you are on this planet. In our serious countdown to the SDG Summit, as Charles said, we are today dealing with two interlinked and life-embracing SDGs, SDG 13 on climate and SDG 14 on life below water or simply on the oceans. We've come a long way in a short period of time, historically speaking. But when it comes to safeguarding the environment on this planet and developing a future built on sustainable development, we have not come far enough. We seem to live in a paralyzing paradox. We know what ails the planet. We know what to do. We have the means to do it and the money, yet we fail to act. That is why it is also necessary to repeat what we know and expand on this knowledge. If we don't, we will lose track of what we know and fail to see and understand the urgency of acting, as well as fail to recognize what we have accomplished. The first report on global warming was written by scientists and published in 1953. The World Meteorological Organization of the UN had already been founded in 1950 and has since continued its atmospheric research. The UN Environment Programme, UNEP, joined forces with WMO during the 1970s and identified already in that decade the threats to the ozone layer. Together, the two UN bodies, UNEP and WMO, founded the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change in IPCC in 1988, which quickly became a most respected global scientific body advising politicians and decision makers on climate issues. Soon after its foundation, IPCC began publishing its respected reports, laying the grounds not only for our understanding of one of the most formidable threats to our existence, increased global warming, but also outlining what to do, how to do it, and how quickly we had to act. Their first assessments were met with skepticism, but IPCC kept repeating what they found, continued its research, and accompanied by other reports from the UN on social, economic, and environmental problems, this insistent work resulted in the UN Convention on Climate Change in 1992, the Kyoto Protocol in 1997, and the Paris Climate Accord in 2015. One of UNEP's first programs after its foundation in 1972 was the oceans. UNEP began this work through the Regional Seas Program in 1974. And despite a politically volatile climate, managed to involve all nations around the Mediterranean, the European, the African, and Middle Eastern countries, to focus on this transboundary issue, the ocean. Issues related to oceans that we now discuss in depth were back in the 1970s novelties on the political arena. The UN Conference on the Human Environment in Stockholm in 1972, which founded UNEP, made several recommendations about the ocean and also proposed a moratorium on whale hunting, which was adopted by the International Whaling Commission in 1982. UNEP and the UN kept expanding the ocean issues beyond the whales, also to encompass all oceans of the world. Our knowledge and understanding of environment and sustainability issues have expanded through constant repetitions. New research has been added, critical assessments carried out, resulting in new reports. They have then been adopted by the UN and added to its expanding agendas. Advocacy groups and civil society have lobbied decision makers who have in most cases developed new and relevant policies. The Brundtland Commission's report, Our Common Future from 1987, is case in point. It is also one of the first reports showing the interlinked nature of sustainable development. We would not have had Agenda 21 in 1992, nor the Rio Conventions as a result, nor the Rio Plus 20 Outcome Report, The Future We Want, from 2012, which resulted in the SDGs and the 2030 Agenda, had it not been for this diligent and repetitive work. What is often forgotten or overlooked, but which is also a substantive result from this constant repetition and expansion of knowledge, are global agreements to a common set of values and norms and a growing understanding of the interlinked nature of these issues. In our webinars, we always refer to the complete title of the SDGs because they encompass more than the sometimes misleading abbreviations. SDG 13 is about take urgent action to combat climate change and its impacts. And SDG 14 is about to conserve and sustainably use the oceans, seas, and marine resources for sustainable development. These two SDGs in today's webinar have often been referred to as the most interlinked goals of them all. Without the climate which envelops the world, nothing exists, and the oceans covers 70% of the world's surface. The two are inextricably interlinked. We all know the dynamics between the oceans and the climate. SDG 13 on climate is supplied with 5 targets and is a good example of how complexities of an issue evolves over time and helps us understand how difficult and contentious these issues can be. The number of climate COPs with their background papers, including the IPCC reports, have all helped us understand the interlinked nature of climate, how it affects everything from our individual health to the sustainability of biodiversity. We understand more fully today issues like climate justice, climate adaptation, resilience and mitigation. And last year's COP added another important concept, that of loss and damages. Sustainable Development Goal 14 on the oceans is supplied with 10 targets. It also happens to, by the way, to be the most underfunded SDG. The oceans are the planet's largest ecosystem. They regulate the climate and are thus also rightly called our biggest ally against climate change. The oceans also provide livelihoods for billions. The problem is that the oceans of the world are in serious trouble. With the ocean representing over 90% of the living space for species on the planet, protecting the ocean has finally become a global priority. And because of that, UNESCO has declared this decade a decade for science of the oceans. Their motto is simply the science we need for the ocean we want. A side event at the last ocean conference pointed to some of the interlinkages that relate to SDG 14. The organizers stated that source-to-sea solutions in contributing to the achievement of SDG 14 on seas and oceans are key to achieving SDG 6 on clean water and sanitation, and through its strong interlinkages, SDG 13 on climate action, and SDG 15 on ecosystems and biodiversity on land. The side event also identified cross-cutting initiatives that could address source-to-sea challenges and ensure benefits across the entire water cycle through partnerships, knowledge sharing, and commitments to stimulate source-to-sea action on the ground. The biodiversity of the ocean was also a topic of last year's COP15 in Montreal on biodiversity. The so-called 30 by 30 pledge to protect by 2030 30% of the planet's lands and inland waters, as well as marine and coastal areas, was agreed to by COP15. Implementing this pledge is critical in order to achieve the ocean-related goals and targets of the 2030 agenda, including the Global Biodiversity Framework decision. There are many difficult challenges in trying to fulfill the targets identified under SDG 14. This clearly showed itself under the recent Intergovernmental Conference on Marine Biodiversity of Areas Beyond National Jurisdiction, or as it is known, the BBNJ. The negotiators ran into difficulties when they were trying to balance conservation and sustainable use. And when benefit sharing requirements were added to the equation, achieving the right balance proved to be even more difficult. At the same time, negotiators knew that the oceans were facing unprecedented threats: climate change, pollution, including plastic pollution, overfishing, habitat destruction, ocean acidification, and underwater noise. All this has severely affected significant parts of the ocean. This new treaty for biodiversity in areas beyond national jurisdiction, which was adopted, ultimately aims to reverse these negative trends and ensure long-term sustainability of ocean ecosystems. But the outcome marked the successful conclusion of a 20-year-long voyage for the international community, which agreed on the new ocean treaty as a framework to address many of the challenges the ocean is facing, including those itemized in SDG 14. Repeated and consistent work again proved successful. The outcome was a victory for multilateralism, claimed the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. The relationship between ideas, knowledge, and action is a complex one. This relationship is also what interlinkages are all about, and 50 years of hard, repetitive, and diligent work has resulted in a better understanding of how important these interlinkages are. Making sure the interlinked nature of the goals is understood and acted upon is crucial to the implementation of the 2030 Agenda. As I said at the beginning, we have come a long way in a short period of time, historically speaking, and accomplished a lot. But when we speak about safeguarding the environment and basing our future development on the principles of sustainable development, we clearly have not come far enough. The declaration of the 2019 SDG Summit introduced in focused and urgent terms the decade of action. The declaration for this year's September SDG Summit cannot be less ambitious. The 1972 UN Conference on the Human Environment agreed to the principles of the right to a clean and healthy environment. 50 years later, the UN General Assembly decided that this principle will also be a human right. 50 years, half a century, may not be a long time historically, but we cannot wait another 50 years to implement the 2030 Agenda. That is time we do not have. We have time and again promised the younger generation to build a better future. If we are not to be labeled a generation of liars, we have to fulfill this promise and act now. Acting now is urgent, and this urgency must be the guiding principle for the declaration for this year's SDG Summit. Thank you for your attention.
Jan Gustav, thank you so much for giving us that framework for today's webinar, and for despite the lack of progress we've seen in some areas, for the hopeful tone that you often bring to these events. So thank you to Jan Gustav. And now I'd like to welcome my colleague, Dr. David Horn, who will introduce our panel of experts. David is an assistant professor at Trinity Business School and Trinity College Dublin, and a fellow at Stakeholder Forum since since 2018, he has been conducting research on data and governance framework for the SDGs, with a focus on multi-stakeholder partnerships and their role in effective and equitable implementation. David is the author of A New Approach to Partnerships for SDG Transformations and Towards a Portfolio Approach, Partnerships for Sustainable Transformations. From 2018 to 2020, David was a visiting scholar at Columbia University's Center for Sustainable Development in New York and the UN Sustainable Solutions Network as well. David, you have the floor.
Thank you, Charles, for the introduction, and to Jan Gustav for your valuable comments. On behalf of Stakeholder Forum, I'd like to welcome everyone to our discussion of SDGs 13 and 14. We have seven excellent speakers for the discussion. Like in previous webinars, each speaker will first discuss their recommendations on ways to account for interlinkages among SDGs. This will then be followed by questions from the audience. Please submit your questions in the Q&A section, and I will now briefly introduce the speakers to everyone. First, you will hear from a development and conservation leader with 18 years of experience in development and conservation organization across Africa and Asia, Mr. Charles Karangwa, Global Head of Nature-Based Solutions at the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, IUCN, and head of its Nature-Based Solution Management Hub. Second, we are delighted to have with us a climate and energy governance researcher who has done pioneering work on transnational climate actions and their interlinkages with the SDGs. Dr. Lisa Sanderink, Assistant Professor of Energy Transition and Climate Governance at University of Twente in the section of Governance and Technology for Sustainability. Our third speaker is an experienced macroeconomist and co-chair of the T20 Task Force on Accelerating SDGs, Exploring New Pathways to the 2030 Agenda, Dr. Fahmida Khatun, Executive Director of the Center for Policy Dialogue in Bangladesh, a leading think tank in South Asia. Fourth, it is a great pleasure to have with us a passionate marine biologist and founder and executive director of Save the Sharks of the Sea, an organization that works to protect and preserve sharks specifically, Mr. Frederick Meyer, leader of the ocean team at the Worldwide Fund for Nature in Norway, where he works to promote sustainable ocean management worldwide. Our fifth speaker has worked internationally in ocean policy and marine biodiversity research for 30 years, including for UN agencies, research organizations, and NGOs with a special focus on small island developing states. Dr. Maria Bierhus, Head of Science Policy Research at University of Edinburgh Nippon Foundation's Ocean Voices Program and Director of Coastal Policies and Humanities Research, a Vancouver-based consultancy specializing in policy-relevant ocean research that integrates traditional knowledge and science. Our sixth speaker is an experienced business development manager with Wave and Tidal Energy Technologies and a board member of Ocean Energy Ireland, or Ocean Energy Europe, sorry. Mr. Oliver Ragg, Commercial Director at Orbital Marine Power Limited, an innovative Scottish engineering company focused on the development of low-cost, predictable, and scalable tidal turbine technology. Last and by no means least, we are delighted to have with us a leading expert in international and comparative law with a focus on biodiversity, environmental governance, and linkages between equity, human rights, and international environmental law. Dr. Elisa Morguera, Professor of Global Environmental Law and Director of the One Ocean Hub at the University of Strathclyde's Law School in Edinburgh. It's a great pleasure to have you all here, and we look forward to your contributions. I will now give the floor to Mr. Charles Karangwa. We would be very grateful for your recommendations on transformative actions for the SDGs.
Thank you very much, David, for the opportunity. I would like to thank the organizers for having us to speak about the SDG 13 and 14 in particular in today's webinar. And of course, before then, I'll do the same, sending greetings and to everyone who is participating to this. My name is Charles Karangwa. I head the Nature-Based Solutions team at the International Union for Conservation of Nature. And my presentation this afternoon will just be, again, linking the question we are discussing today, SDG 13 and 14, but also the opportunity to use some of the already approved or agreed upon concepts to address and respond to action required for these two SDGs. Next slide, please. So nature-based solutions, one of the concepts which has been recently endorsed, I will come back to that, by the COP27, but also by the COP15 of biodiversity, has taken quite a long journey. It has really evolved from a concept paper to a negotiated approach until it has been approved as a global a concept that can help accelerate or catalyze action for climate, but also recently for biodiversity. And as you can see on this kind of journey, which is continuing, as I mentioned up, it started quite long time ago, 2009, with IUCN and UNCCC position paper, which was building on the ecosystem-based approaches, but also how do we move the concept of EBA and ecosystem-based approaches to action-oriented concept. And this has really been developing. The good news is in 2016, for the first time, nature-based solutions definition was adopted by the IUCN Congress in Hawaii. I was privileged to be there, and that was my first year, and I remember the ambience that was in the room. And after that approval of the definition, which I will come back to in a minute, there have been quite significant uptake of nature-based solutions. And it was published in quite a lot of paper, thousands of them, but also different users started using that. And until 2020, when the IUCN as well published the first ever global standards for nature-based solutions. And this led to a number of other global level uptake, the adoption of the definition by the UN Environment Assembly in 2022, but also the inclusion of the nature-based solution in other Rio conventions, which I will come back. Next slide, please. Again, this is a kind of opportunity to also shed light on this issue. Nature-based solutions, in most cases, will be looked at as a new concept, but we are not talking about something new. We are talking about how do you leverage on historically successful approaches to think about transitioning to action-oriented process and concept. So we are talking about really a definition which has been endorsed and approved and adopted by the UN Environment Assembly. And there's a couple of keywords here, and I would come back to this with the SDG 13 and then 14. So there's action to protect, conserve, restore, sustainably use, and manage natural modified terrestrial, freshwater, coastal, and marine ecosystems. So this already speaks to the SDGs we are discussing today. But there's probably the second part of the definition, which is very important, is how these address socioeconomic and environmental challenges. And this links to other SDGs, poverty, among others, but also others that we can talk about. Next slide, please. And as we confirm this definition, this again has been already integrated in many different action on the ground. And the key on this definition is really how nature-based solutions address society challenges that the entire community is facing. So we talked about climate change and its impact on fresh water, but also marine ecosystems. We talk about disaster risk reduction. I think we are already aware about several issues around floods and other problems. The ecosystem around economic development itself, water, food security, human health, among other challenges that the society is facing. So nature-based solutions comes to really provide an opportunity to address these challenges in using a kind of an integrated approach. Next slide. Not sure slides are changing on my side, but not yet. But next slide, please. Again, this links to the discussion today, the SDG 13 and 14, climate action. We look at nature-based solutions as both addressing adaptation, but also mitigation actions, but also life below water. We can talk about all the issues around the marine ecosystem restoration and conservation and protection, but also links with other SDGs, as you can see on my screen. I don't want to stay on this because I'm talking to experts, but I will go to the next slide just to talk about where we are. And I mean, one of the opportunities we have is that nature-based solution evolved as a concept, but the International Union have done quite a lot of work, other many partners with consultation. You can click on the next slide so that you can read the full slide. Keep going. One of the opportunities that there is now a backbone of the standards that is already there, and have been developed in consultation with quite a lot of experts, more than 1,000 of experts that have been consulted, engaged in this process. And the standards have 8 criteria and 28 indicators. So you can assess, measure your action according to the standards. I'll go to the next slide so that I don't stay on this. And these standards have actually helped to transition and easily start looking at how do we address the society challenges and then the climate change issues, the life below water, among others under the SDG 13 and 14 using a nature-based solution. And this has also been evolving in terms of global discussion as well. Next slide. Where we are today, there have been quite significant global uptake of nature-based solution across already the Rio conventions and both climate, biodiversity, but also the land. And the COP15 in Abidjan in 2022 recognized nature-based solution and included that in the decision under the Article 26 as a kind of an action to reverse degradation of the land, but also other multilateral environmental agreement, Ramsar among others, the post-2020 biodiversity framework as well, among other things. So this is a great opportunity. I will be going towards the end, but the opportunity we have, I think, is transitioning from here to this adoption and inclusion of the nature-based solutions into action that can address exactly the challenges that we are facing under climate and the life below water. Next slide, which probably going towards the end of my presentation. So again, accelerating action, and I'm going to the final conclusion. There's a great opportunity to really accelerate action. IUCN have worked with the German government and the COP27 the presidency in Egypt last year to launch what we call ENACT, which is a partnership to really catalyze action at scale to make sure that we can move towards action from this concept. Next slide. But also beyond that, we are working to mobilize and there's a need to catalyze that bigger scale of financing, both from private and the public. So there's a number of instruments which are already out there. But also we need to recognize that there's a still huge gap on financing for nature-based solutions. And my last slide is probably a couple of reflections as we round, is that as now that we have nature-based solutions included in the climate COP, in the biodiversity COP, in the land degradation COP, in the Ramsar, et cetera, but also in the oceans discussions, I think we need to start moving towards mainstreaming this within the policy, but also strategies at national and subnational level. The opportunity for using the standards is already there, so you can easily assess, measure, and scale up your action, but also we have an opportunity now to really accelerate action on nature-based solutions, especially for oceans, but also for climate. Going forward. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much, Charles, especially for highlighting nature-based solutions as transformative solutions that can help us to address multiple SDG challenges, and also for bringing to our attention the role that standards and designs can play in facilitating their rollout. Okay, so I will now give the floor to Dr. Lisa Sanderink. We look forward to your thoughts on ways to align climate actions and the SDGs.
Hello. Hello, everyone. Thanks, David, for the nice introduction. Very happy to be joining this discussion. It has already been quite interesting to listen to my predecessors. So today I would like to focus on the complexity of governance for climate change and the Sustainable Development Goals. Particularly, I will be talking about how interactions can reduce the negative implications of this complexity. So I should first clarify what I consider as governance and why it is complex. I consider governance to be all processes and actors involved in steering policy and behavior towards a common public goal, be it sharing knowledge, be it creating rules, developing financing mechanisms, or anything else, for example, towards a common goal to take urgent climate action, as set out in SDG 13, but also in the Paris Agreement, of course. So governance for climate change and also for more SDGs has become more and more complex. And I say this because it's no longer only exercised by traditional states, but besides international organizations, there are also many regional alliances, city networks, private initiatives, multi-stakeholder partnerships, and many others. And from now on, I will actually refer to all of these as institutions, for your clarity. So To illustrate, together with a few colleagues, we have identified over 100 climate governance institutions at the international level only. So that is not even including all those institutions existing at the national or local level. So let me be clear, because I think this complexity has its benefits towards achieving SDG 13 on climate, because it makes it possible to compartmentalize this very complex, large challenge of climate change. It is seen as quite useful to disaggregate it in smaller challenges that can be addressed in parallel, but with different degrees of progress and at different speeds. And in addition to so many institutions being involved, there's also a very wide range of perspectives and types of knowledge. So this really stimulates innovation and, you know, widens the range of possible solutions and tailor-made solutions. But still, I think some degree of overlap or interaction is required to ensure that the trade-offs between climate change and all the other SDGs are taken into account. So before highlighting those recommendations that we are seeking for, what is the state of affairs? So I would like to just provide some insights from my research, starting with functional interactions, as I would like to call them. And with this, I refer to the more inevitable connections between institutions simply by addressing similar themes. So SDG 13 on climate change might be more than all the others connected to other SDGs. So this can result in of course, co-benefits. So for example, progress on SDG 7 for sustainable energy is very likely to address some of the fundamental causes of climate change. However, it can also be more problematic. So the implementation of climate policy can also negatively affect other SDGs. So for example, the rising demand for bioenergy could have a negative effect on food and water security in SDGs 2 and 6. So then the question is, do these institutions, did this whole variety of institutions resemble these quite important connections? Together with two colleagues, I specifically looked at 72 transnational climate institutions, which are international collaborations between non-state and sub-state actors. We studied how their climate actions are linked to other SDGs. David Horan already referred to it. We found that their activities are linked to all other SDGs, except for SDG 5 on gender equality. And in particular, climate actions in transnational climate initiatives are linked to three SDGs. This is SDG 12 on responsible consumption and production, SDG 9 on industry, innovation, and infrastructure, and SDG 7 on sustainable energy. Now, the SDGs that were only marginally linked were SDG 3 on good health and well-being, SDG 4 on quality and education, and interestingly, also SDG 14 on life below water. So it's very interesting to see all these connections, and we have created all these network graphs that show these connections in more detail. It makes information very useful for policymakers by demonstrating which climate initiative could benefit from sharing information and best practices with another due to their thematic overlaps. I will be happy to share the link to those network graphs, but I would actually like to take it one step further, because it's nice that we have these insights into these thematic and functional interactions between climate institutions and the SDG, but the challenge remains to connect the institutions themselves. And that is what I will focus on for the rest of my few minutes, because this is what we refer to as institutional interactions. So situations in which the policy processes, knowledge, norms, or functions of two or more institutions are connected. And this in turn affects the development and performance of those institutions. And here I can only draw on insights from my research on institutions at the intersection of SDG 13 on climate change and SDG 7 on energy. And what I found is the following. I found an abundance of cognitive interactions, and this means there is a lot of knowledge exchange. There are reports being written, they are shared very widely, they are actually used by other institutions, and interestingly, institutions also team up a lot to, you know, write the reports together, or even set up repositories or platforms to organize all this wealth of information. So that's great. I also found considerable normative interactions, and this refers to the alignment of norms and commitments across institutions. And I feel like the Paris Agreement and Agenda 2030 provide a very strong framework for all these institutes to align their commitments with. So discursively, there is in any case a high degree of consensus of that we should take action. To some extent, I also found political interactions referring to really sharing concrete political mechanisms. So we see institutions visiting each other's conferences, organizing platforms to collaborate, or very specific examples are institutions like IRENA and IEA signing memorandums of understanding with a real intent to collaborate. Still, at the impact level, I've also learned about quite some concerns in the field of all these institutions. For example, about the duplication of work. So institutions are doing similar work without knowing that of each other, resulting in inefficiency, or even to conflictive impacts. So the activities of one institution diminish the work of others. And it appears particularly difficult to keep track of who is doing what and what are the added value of those institutions. So as a result of that, it is very difficult for all these different parties, governments, public actors, private actors, to decide which institutions to participate in, but also the institutions themselves to identify what the gaps are that need to be filled. So this brings me to recommendations. And the first, and this might be stating the obvious, is that instead of creating more knowledge, which is good, but knowledge is there, institutions should share more about procedural information. So what is it that they are trying to achieve and with what instruments? And if this is shared, it will be easier to identify conflicts, overlaps, or gaps. Second, I think political collaborations should go beyond visiting each other's conferences and more focus on facilitating feedback and coordination mechanisms. So for example, setting benchmarks and targets to keep track of institutions' performance. And third, interactions should also extend towards the more unconventional partners. For example, the fossil fuel industry, financial sectors, and because as a fellow researcher once wrote, we can only achieve the targets if we deal with conflict and controversies. And finally, I want to mention that throughout my research, I found that multilateral cooperation remains key in creating a global understanding and consensus. So I think we should also focus on maintaining that strong institutional umbrella that we have with the Paris Agreement and the SDGs. So to conclude, I think climate change and the SDGs are clearly strongly connected, and this should also be resembled in the governance structures that are trying to address it. So not only thematically, but also institutionally. And that's where I will conclude. Thanks a lot, and I will be happy to answer any questions.
Thanks a million, Lisa, and especially for highlighting that complex problems require complex governance to deliver tailored solutions, and filling gaps in this context is a way to drive forward the program. So I will now give the floor to Dr. Framida Khatun. We would love to hear your recommendations on ways to accelerate the implementation of SDG 13.
Thank you very much. I'm really privileged to be speaking at this forum. So I will focus on three points with regards to SDG 13 on climate action and reflect on the issues related to least developed countries and developing countries. So my first point is that the target for keeping the global temperature below 2 degrees Celsius and within 1.5 degrees Celsius seems to be a far reality now, given the changed context since the Paris Climate Agreement in 2015. So there are several studies which indicate that if we continue to emit at this rate, then we will not be able to meet the emission targets, which has been set by the global leaders. Scientific evidences in the IPCC reports also indicate the extent and the rate of emissions and the consequences of such emissions. And several studies also reveal that if the rate continues what we are doing at this point in time, then there will be there will not be fulfillment of the emission reduction targets. So there is a need for expanding our efforts towards emission reduction. So, and we also know that in terms of emissions, there is a global imbalance. Indeed, the advanced countries have historically emitted substantially higher than the other countries. However, we see that there has been commitments at the various global forum, including the COPs, and particularly at the COP26, when we have seen that countries have enhanced their commitments towards net zero emissions and towards stabilizing global temperature. So the countries have taken accelerated enhanced commitments towards reaching the net zero emission by the middle of the century, so that we can keep the targets of the Paris Climate Agreement. However, for that, we need to enhance the process. As I have mentioned, that several studies have made it clear that we are off track. So since the Paris Agreement, the global economy, the political scenario have changed a lot. We have been affected by the global pandemic, which was followed by the Ukraine war, which has changed the whole geopolitical equation. The power balance has changed. Besides, we are observing economic crisis and financial stress. And this has exacerbated the impact of climate change. At this day and age, we are living in a multipolar situation where we are seeing that the way we are living, it's not quite healthy, both not only in terms of climate action, but also economically and politically. There are institutions which are not functioning as expected in terms of providing enhanced finance. So this is the second point I want to highlight, that the importance of finance, and then the importance of technology transfer, which is another important issue with regard to fulfillment of the climate commitments made by the global leaders. Developed countries can play a critical role in meeting global targets in GHG emission. And we have seen that countries have made commitments for reducing fossil fuel subsidies, which is really harmful. So this reduction of fossil fuel subsidies for making a transition towards renewable energy is the key for emission reductions. But the need for supporting these activities by concrete measures are important. Developing countries, on the other hand, are at the receiving end of this impact of climate change, and they are insignificant contributors to the GHG emission. And as a result, most of the times, many countries in the poorer region, they are just silent spectators as they are at the receiving end. And we have also seen that the high level forums like G7, G20, COP meetings, UNFCCC, and other multilateral organizations, they can play a very important role in terms of taking that forward. There are also opportunities for developing countries to express their concerns and express their concrete requirements at these forums and platforms. We have seen that despite the call to eliminate subsidies on fossil fuel, there are instances that this sector is being subsidized in one way or the other by several countries. We are happy to see that in the recent meetings of the G7 and also the G20, they are making enhanced commitments and renewed commitments towards reducing fossil fuel subsidies. The second issue I want to highlight is that the issue of enhanced finance. The commitment for creating $100 billion for the developing countries, which was made in 2009, many years back, has not been fulfilled yet. There is also another commitment for creating $100 billion SDR for the vulnerable countries, which also remains unfulfilled. Indeed, the need for finance has increased from billions to trillions. This request for stronger commitments by global leaders, countries in the global south are suitably positioned to raise their voices at global platforms. The third and last point I want to highlight is to talk about the transition towards renewable energy or towards green energy in the context of the developing countries. While making transitions or while emphasizing the need for making a transition towards green economy, we have to remember the socioeconomic context of these countries. Of course, we want to make a transition in line with the nationally determined contribution commitments. These countries are suffering from many economic and social challenges. I mean, the developing countries and least developed countries. So their green transition may not be as fast as the developed countries. This context has to be kept in mind while we make climate commitments. These commitments have to be complementary to the objectives of sustainable development. And we should not look at development only from a narrow lens, rather from a holistic perspective. And this will encompass education, social protection, women's empowerment, and employment. Indeed, employment, gender equality, and socioeconomic development are the key components of a just and inclusive transition. Only a holistic development approach can ensure just transition that stands on economic, social, and environmental pillars. So with these, I want to end. These are some of the highlights and some of the issues from the perspective of the Global South. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Fahmida, for these valuable insights, and especially for highlighting the need to strengthen linkages with SDG 17 and the role that mobilizing the achievement of SDG 7 can play in tackling climate change. And I think it was also especially important the way you highlighted that just transition requires accounting for interlinkages across the entire agenda. Okay, I will now give the floor to Mr. Frederick Meyer. In light of your work on sustainable oceans management, we would be grateful for your recommendations on ways to accelerate the implementation of SDG 40.
Thank you very much. Good morning, good day, and good afternoon to everybody. And thank you so much for the invitation to come and share some of our thoughts from WWF Norway, or WWF as an organization talking about life below water. I will share my screen if I'm able to, so you will have some to look at. You should be able to see a presentation pretty soon, not just me on the water, but also a presentation. Does it work, David? Yep, perfect, thanks. Before diving in more into the specifics on SDG 14, life below water, I would like to highlight the situation a little bit more for the oceans of the world. And did you know that the ocean is touching you every day, that the ocean is touching you even when you sit in front of your computer right here, right now? And that is true, even for those who have never seen the ocean with their own eyes throughout the entire lifetime, the ocean is touching us. With every breath that we take, with every drop of water that we drink, in other words, in every second, every minute, and every day of our life on this planet, the ocean is touching us. And as astronaut Joe Allen once put it, I had to learn everything about my life support system, and then do everything I could to take care of my life support system, especially when up in space. And being an active diver, things are not so much different. I learned that the most important thing is to take care of my life support system and how to use it in a safe way. And looking at this picture, I'm just saying life support system. We need to learn much more of the ocean, that is, our life support system. And we need to do so much more in order to take care of it. But we do know quite a lot already. As a child growing up, and we learn in school that approximately 70% of the Earth's surface is ocean. And even though it's not taught in school, we also know that as much as 95% of the habitats on this planet, living areas, is in the ocean. And another fact that is true is that the ocean provides us with anywhere between 50 and 80% of the oxygen we breathe every day. The ocean takes care of us and is the main reason why human life on this planet is even possible. Mother Earth should perhaps be renamed. A more fitting name would be Mother Ocean. That's how important the ocean is to us and to all the other things on this planet, our life support system. But instead of caring for the ocean, instead of making sure that it stays healthy, we overexploit it by overfishing, polluting it with oil, plastic, and other waste, and we are giving it a fever by increasing its temperature and making it more acid. Coral reefs are bleaching, fish stocks are collapsing, and seagrass meadows are disappearing. Global populations of mammals, birds, amphibians, and fish have suffered an average of 68% decline in less than half a century. Nature is disappearing, and fast. We are now in the middle of the sixth mass extinction of animal life that we know of in the history of this planet, because we humans use too much and protect too little. Nature is screaming with the sound of silence. And at the same time, the scientists are yelling out alarm signals that no longer can be overlooked or overheard. We need to be better at protecting our oceans, and we need to protect more of the ocean, and we need to do it now. Today, less than 5% of the oceans, planet's oceans are protected. The areas are way too small, and there are way too few to have a global impact. Just to bring you an example, here in Norway, where I'm sitting currently, and Norway is a nation which likes to look upon itself as one of the ocean heroes. We have protected approximately 1% of our national waters, 1%. We should have been at 10% by 2020, but that was just one more environmental commitment us Norwegians didn't achieve. Now the world's leading scientists are telling us that at least 30% of the world's oceans need to be protected by 2030 if we are to succeed in taking care of the Mother Ocean and all the, her life-giving ecosystem services. Services absolutely crucial for human life. Services like oxygen to breathe, water to drink, and food to eat. And the question shouldn't be about protection or use, because protection is use. Protection is using a management tool for taking better care of coastal zones or the high seas. And why are we so afraid of this word, marine protection? I will claim that marine protection is one of the most misunderstood words in the ocean debate. People simply don't understand what marine protection means. Is it one thing that the whole pandemic has taught us? It is that protection is key. Who out there following this online is against protecting your loved ones from COVID? No one, right? But at the same time, we try to have an activity in our society. The same thing goes for fire protection or hearing protection. We take care of the things that we care about and we need. But at the same time, we do have different types of activities in our everyday life. And that's how we must look at nature too. And in this case, the ocean. Because protection is not to have huge glass lids to be put over the entire ocean area, but to have a tool that we must use in order to take care of our most valuable and important coastal zones or other ocean areas, such as the high seas. It's not about stopping all human activities, ongoing or new, but it's to make sure that nature values and ecosystem functions of the ocean remains intact while we use it. Intact to support life, among others, human life. Because the ocean health is human health. The ocean doesn't need human, but we humans, we need the ocean for everything that we do, everything that we are. And what will you say to the children and grandchildren when they ask, why didn't you do something? Why didn't you save the sharks, the coastal cod, the kelp forest, and the coral reefs while there was still time? Well, ladies and gentlemen, the time is now. We are the first and the last generation who really can do anything about the climate crisis and the nature crisis that are destroying the oceans, destroying us. And we need to tackle both at the same time, the climate crisis and the nature crisis, that is, as they are two sides of the same coin. less emissions and more nature. And we can do it. We do have the knowledge and we do have the know-how. It's all about will and courage. We have to have the will to do what is right, what the scientists are telling us is right. And we need to have the courage to do so, because some of the things we must do is unpopular in the beginning, but it's the only way to save our oceans. It's the only way to save life on Earth as we know it. Let's protect it better, the ocean that is, and thereby give the future generations to come a healthy planet to call home. And implementing the commitments made in the Global Biodiversity Framework, the Paris Agreement, and the agreement done now for the marine biodiversity of areas beyond national jurisdiction are absolutely crucial steps in order to solve both the climate crisis and the nature crisis, both for the ocean and thereby for the rest of the planet. And if you are to remember one thing from all that I have said, remember the words of this extraordinary lady, her deepness, Dr. Sylvia Earle. You should treat the ocean as your life depends on it, because it really does. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Frederick, for highlighting the importance of the oceans and the need to act now. I will now cede the floor to Dr. Maria Vieros. We will be grateful for your recommendations.
Thank you very much for that. That it's such a pleasure to be here with all of you and to follow all these great speakers. I sadly don't have a PowerPoint for you, but I would like to speak to one aspect of SDG 14, which really interlinks with, I would argue, all other SDGs, and that is the issue of blue economy. And as we go forward with SDG 14 and its implementation, the blue economy has really become central strategy for many countries in how they approach SDG 14. And this is particularly if you look at the voluntary commitments that have been made by a wide range of countries. And in particular, SDG 14 Target 7 aims to, by 2030, increase the economic benefits to small island developing states and least developed countries from the sustainable use of marine resources. And that includes sustainable management of fisheries, agriculture, and tourism, but also other ocean sectors. And while that Target 7 very much refers to SIDs and LDCs, it seems that that blue economy approach has been embraced pretty much universally by coastal countries. And it is really important for countries to realize their sustainable development aspirations within an ocean context. And in both concept and implementation, it really has come to embody much of SDG 14 for many countries. It's related to many other SDGs, I would argue most of them, and blue economies encompass aspects of environmental conservation. They should encompass aspects of economies. They should be transformative. I think that much we can agree. This should not be business as usual anymore. And ideally, in an ideal world, blue economy should seek to balance economic growth with environmental sustainability and social equity. But this is quite a lofty goal. So whether we get there really very much depends on how blue economies are designed on a national level, on the local level. And if these are designed in such a way that they take interlinkages into action, they can address climate action, but also poverty, hunger, gender equality, education, clean energy, inequality, decent work and economic growth, strong institutions, just to mention a few of the other SDGs. But to do that is really up to the design and implementation of blue economies. And one issue we then come up against is the fact that we don't actually at this moment have a common internationally accepted definition of what a blue economy is or an understanding of what it really means. So the question then remains on whether we actually do need a common definition or at least some type of description. And I have to admit that I don't actually have an answer to this question, but I would like to offer some thoughts around this. Firstly, it has been well documented that the blue economy can mean many different things for many different countries, and that there's a multitude of national definitions out there. And this is not at all surprising. Countries are unique in their national circumstances and in their aspirations, in their capabilities, capacities. And so their approach to the blue economy development may look equally unique as well. For example, some countries view the ocean mainly as a source of economic growth and innovation. And these countries may emphasize the development of new sectors of the ocean economy and new technologies. There's been a lot of talk about renewable energy and marine biotechnology, for example, and how might these feature in a blue economy. Often these are countries that have the resources and aspirations towards such new technologies, often developed countries. And with that kind of focus, blue economies can certainly fulfill SDGs 8, decent work and economic growth, and 9 on industry, innovation, infrastructure. But we then have to also ask the question that if these are the primary SDGs considered, would economic growth come at the expense of environmental protection? And how would we incorporate equity, for example, and gender issues into blue economy development? So these are the important considerations in implementation. And if countries' blue economy plans, for example, include fossil fuel-based activities or other extractive activities, and many of them do, what would be the impacts on SDG 13, for example, and 14 overall? Then there's a set of countries, and this is true of, for example, many, although not all, SIDS countries that have prioritized issues such as food security, livelihoods, community-led actions, artisanal fisheries, and poverty eradication. And this is an approach that really primarily focuses on SDGs 1, 2, and 3, along with 14B on artisanal fisheries. And these have become the priorities a lot around which blue economies are built. Here, there's a focus on ocean equity, and the innovations included may relate to low-cost new technologies, as well as the sustainability of existing activities. And finally, there's categories of countries whose blue economy approaches incorporate many of the components that I just listed, maybe even all of them, from new technologies to livelihoods of coastal communities, as well as innovative financing approaches. And this category also includes many SIDS countries. For example, I recently looked at the paper written by Khalil Hassan Ali from Trinidad and Tobago, and he demonstrated how blue economy plans and aspirations are different between countries in the Caribbean, which is an area that one might expect to be more homogeneous, but in fact, it is not. All countries are very unique. So the lesson out of this, I think the key lesson for me at least, is that because countries are different in how they see their blue economies developing and the sectors that might be included and the contributions of national economies from these blue economies, there really is no one-size-fits-all solution to how this is done. So moving forward then, the question remains on whether the lack of common definition or understanding for a blue economy is a problem. But I would actually like to remind though many of us that there are many other concepts in environmental management that have not been well defined. And one that I have come across quite often in my career is the concept of ecosystem approach, where different types of guidance and principles exist, but there really is no single agreed upon definition. And this has then allowed countries and communities to innovate and to develop their own approaches. So if the blue economy becomes something that's too prescriptive or too top down, will we then lose out on local innovations and the benefits of integrating different types of knowledge, for example, traditional knowledge, into how we implement blue economies? But on the flip side, there's a danger that without a common definition or at least an understanding, blue economies will in some case result in greenwashing, or we might call it blue washing in this case. One way to minimize or manage that risk is to incorporate and implement blue economy plans within the framework of marine spatial planning, for example, or similar integrated marine management approaches, which include ecosystem protection as a priority as well. In these cases, adaptive management, along with monitoring and evaluating results, become increasingly important. And if you have neighboring countries that have similar understanding of what the blue economy means, it would make it easier to develop regional ocean management strategies and plans. But overall, I think it is extremely important that in such processes, all voices are included and all voices are heard, including the voices of communities. So there is a need to address those power imbalances between stakeholders going forward, and that there always will be power imbalances. So what we, I think, need going forward, and now I get into the recommendation part, is continued discussion and sharing of experiences. The Blue Economy Conference, for example, and other modalities of sharing experiences remain extremely important. And there should be an element of mutual learning from different approaches from different countries on what has worked in specific cases, what has resulted in a lack of equity or environmental protection, for example. And this is particularly important now that countries are either in the process of developing blue economy plans and strategies, or having developed those plans, moving towards implementing them. So perhaps having a case database of case studies, an analysis of such case studies might be helpful in the long run. And based on what we then learn from this implementation, the development of guidance or even principles, as has been done with other approaches, may become important, perhaps sooner rather than later. So to sum up, there is or may not be one size fits all solution or recipe for how blue economy should be implemented any more than countries themselves all fit the same mold. Blue economy as a relatively new concept without an internationally accepted definition is malleable enough to incorporate within it bold and innovative solutions. And we hope that those kinds of bold solutions do come forward from it. It is important that we learn from many experiences and that we listen to many different voices, particularly if we move towards developing common guidance on blue economies. And it is important that we amplify community voices and those of Indigenous peoples and local communities. And as previous speakers have noted, this is also equally true that business as usual will not slow or even halt ocean degradation. I mean, do you need a fundamental shift on how we view the ocean, how we value the ocean? And this includes intangible values. And while I have talked about the economic and other values here quite a lot, we should not forget about those other intangible values. We do need to incorporate positive and equitable social and environmental outcomes into blue economies. So with that, hopefully blue economies can be part of that shift towards a healthier ocean. And with that, I'd like to say thank you very much.
Thank you very much for sharing that wealth of insights, especially for highlighting how different approaches to blue economy can realize different sets of synergies and trade-offs, and the need to engage local communities to account for these linkages and to make blue economy a truly transformative solution. So I will now give the floor to Oliver Ragg. We would love to hear your thoughts on ways to tackle climate change by enhancing oceans' contribution to climate mitigation.
David, thank you very much for the introduction there. And everyone else, thank you very much for inviting me along to the session here today. I suppose from a perspective where I come at this from is a bit different to a number of the other speakers that are here today. I work for a company called Orbital Marine Power. We build floating tidal technology, tidal platforms. So we're looking to obviously address Sustainable Development Goal, I believe it's 13, looking at ways that we can work to address climate change, but do that in a responsible way. It's in harmony with the oceans. One of the critical bits that we look at really is, we consider is how are we going to transition to a future net zero energy system? What are the forms of clean renewable energy that are going to power society in 30 years' time, in 2050? What are we going to need? And we're going to need a mix of renewable energies. We can see that there's been excellent penetration in some countries for particularly solar and wind energy. But we're also seeing in some of those countries where you have high penetration of these types of renewables, where this can cause, you know, big fluctuations in terms of price, large amounts of storage being required, which can obviously lead to kind of fluctuations in energy availability in the future. So the great thing about ocean energy and specifically in tidal energy is, you know, the tides are predictable hundreds of years out into the future. You know, you get these periods of times where the sun's not shining and the wind's not blowing, but over those times, the tide is still flowing. And this is a really important factor, we think, that can contribute to the support of establishing a future clean energy system for the world over. I mean, one of the things as well to point out, ocean energy projects specifically, you know, they're predominantly located in peripheral coastal communities. A lot of the work that we do, and I know others across the ocean energy sector do, is look at how these projects can benefit the communities in these areas. So there's been a lot of, there's a lot of opportunity for job creation in these areas. And we can also see, reskilling of people who are already active within the marine environment for other sectors, how they can transition across to work within the area of ocean renewable energy. I think the other thing that I wanted to touch on very briefly as I'm going through this is, if we're looking at sustainable development goal recommendations and areas that we're considering here, is that it feels as a whole, there's a lot of positive conversation which has gone on in terms of, trying to look at how we consider, sustainable development and how we look at how to address climate change and to do that in a safe way in the marine environment. But it seems there's a complete disconnect in most countries, I think it would be fair to say from our lived experience, between trying to understand, technologies such as ours and other ocean energy technologies, which are trying to address the issues of climate change, can often get stuck up and held up for incredibly long periods of time looking at planning and regulation, getting approvals to put, first of kind systems into the water to prove their ability to generate clean power. It's also really important for me to highlight, there have been, in the region of 30 different ocean energy technologies deployed globally, and none of them have had any negative environmental impacts. However, even now, it's still quicker to consent and get approvals for continued oil and gas fossil fuel extraction from the sea than it is to get approvals to install additional clean renewable energy from the oceans. The regulation very much looks at the direct impact within the marine environment, so everything under the water. But I believe, as one of the other speakers was saying, look, the marine environment isn't just what happens underneath the water. We are Mother Ocean that we represent at the moment. And one thing that's absolutely not accounted for when we're looking at regulation, environmental impacts, is the wider impact on the climate that additional fossil fuel production is having. We know, and it's scientifically proven, the impact that additional fossil fuel extraction is having on the global environment. Yet this isn't regulated against and prevented for additional oil and gas extraction. Whereas at the moment, there is a question over the direct impact that ocean energy technologies have on the ocean environment. What we need to do is we need to move away from what we're looking at as kind of business as usual, and we heard about that a lot at the moment. And I suppose without sounding coy about it, I suppose we need to move to business unusual. Now we're not going to transition to a clean energy future just continuing to do the things that we're doing at the moment. We need to change that. We need to look at different regulatory approaches and take a more risk-based approach. Okay, maybe there are some questions about the wider impacts of ocean renewable energy, But we need to be given the chance to look at those things. We know that there are negative impacts associated with continued extraction of fossil fuels. So there's a need for us to transition away from them. And within the global energy mix, ocean energy has a huge opportunity to assist with the decarbonisation and to help kind of spread the generation mix and profile in the future. Thank you very much.
Very much for that contribution and for highlighting the benefits of ocean power and some of the challenges involved in speeding up its implementation, and particularly the role that regulation, better regulation, can help in that regard. Okay, I will now give the floor to Professor Elisa Morgera. We look forward to your recommendations on ways to account for interlinkages across international agreements as they relate to ocean biodiversity.
Thank you so much for this opportunity. And I think that many of the points raised by my colleagues before will come back into my presentation and reflection. So I'm very thankful for the opportunity to share some of the latest thinking and wisdom about how we already seen, I think, incredible developments in the last couple of years about more connected, more system thinking across international governance, but also the many more opportunities we have to really maximize opportunities for SDG synergies, really looking through the lens of SDG 14. And just to say very briefly, I'm here also sharing some of the wisdom that I have co-developed and learned very much from many colleagues in Ghana, Namibia, and South Africa, as well as the two regional universities in the Caribbean and South Pacific, and many colleagues across the marine and social sciences and the arts also in UK institutions. For the past 5 years, we've been working together in quite a unique form of research for sustainable development collaboration. And that has also been done in conversation with many UN bodies, UNEP, the FAO, international human rights bodies, and really trying to understand from the local to the national to the international level, what are the barriers to fairness and equity in achieving sustainable development, and really looking at fairness and equity as part of our efforts towards sustainable ocean governance, effective climate change, mitigation and adaptation, and other co-benefits. And so I have just one slide really to look at the, you know, as was said earlier on, we have a very complex landscape of existing and new international fora that discuss SDG 14. We have seen some really significant developments in the last couple of years. We've heard already earlier on that we have now a new international agreement looking at areas beyond national jurisdiction, the high seas, but also the deep sea floor, and how I think new opportunities and very innovative provisions in that agreement, both for participation and transparency of different stakeholders, but also really thinking about regime interaction, very much looking at how different regimes need to come together, potentially discuss their respective mandate and look at the effectiveness of those collective efforts to protect marine biodiversity across regimes. We've also seen what we've been waiting for a really long time, the adoption of a partial agreement under the World Trade Organization on fisheries subsidies. That's quite a turning point, just thinking about the point mentioned above about how SDG 14 remains the least funded SDG. We know how much fishery subsidies amount. I'm not an economist, I'm sure others will have those figures at hand, but it's a significant amount of money, both moving away from unsustainable practices, but also potentially becoming available for more innovative integrated approaches to ocean governance, and in particular, also the protection of small-scale fishers, human rights, and their access to resources and markets. The other interesting development that is ongoing is the negotiations of a plastics treaty. Many of you have referred and have in their minds ocean plastics as a huge issue, not the only threat to ocean health, but certainly one that is also compounding all the other threats, and in fact is both caused by similar causes that cause climate change, so the extraction of fossil fuels and related production, and also limits and in fact undermines the ability of the ocean to contribute to climate change mitigation. So developments, I think, across multiple international organizations, some are quite familiar, some maybe kind of newcomers from an ocean perspective. And I think it is important to keep this mindset of thinking more and more about which other international processes that may not be traditionally seen as relevant to the ocean actually do implicitly or partly contribute or potentially could be intentions with our efforts in more centrally focused, ocean-focused regimes. Also, something that has happened in the last few years has been the integration more formally of the ocean in the international climate change negotiations. This, in a way, is really catching up with what we know in science for a very long time. And it is still quite early to say whether or not the Paris Agreement and all the structures there and the influence that those decisions have on national implementation, on national decisions, but also on the movement of finance privately, as well as global climate finance may have for ocean-based solutions. There's both opportunities and risks there. And maybe a couple of observations I'd like to make about that is that what we see now is a significant engagement of the ocean community in the climate change regime. In some instances, we have, I think, side events at the climate COP now who are maybe more integrated in their thinking about, for instance, deep seabed mining, impacts on climate change, impacts on, say, children's rights that we may have in other ocean forum. And yet it is really difficult at this stage to see to what extent parties to the Paris Agreement will develop clear guidance, building, I think, also on the mistakes of the past about sustainable and inclusive ocean-based action to mitigate and adapt to climate change, and to what extent the climate funding will be directed towards ocean or integrated land and ocean response measures. And with that attention, there's also concerns around whether maybe entrepreneurial interests will be directed to maybe what may appear as quick wins in terms of ocean climate action, which might, however, either a negative impact on relevant human rights or negatively impact on biodiversity and other important SDG at stake. That said, other international regimes also contribute to the ocean and climate nexus. Going back to the BBNJ agreement, we have some innovative provisions that really place very centrally the ocean climate connection in our planning of area-based management measures, but also in our assessment of cumulative impacts on the ocean. And I think one of the maybe most promising provisions in the agreement in terms of strategic environmental assessments, including at the regional level where we are still missing essential basic biodiversity data for us to fully understand the role of the ocean in climate mitigation, as well as the impacts of our ongoing and future activities on the ocean, which may impede its contributions, continued contribution to climate change mitigation. In addition to these areas, which are maybe more in the environmental realm, I think it's really crucial in terms of that systemic thinking, co-benefits and regime interaction, also to take stock of recent developments in international human rights law, the recognition of the human right to a healthy environment and how that has now been embedded in the global biodiversity framework, a forthcoming UN General Comment on children's right to a healthy environment, which also includes considerations and, you know, really takes stocks of children and youth movements on climate change, but also the importance of a healthy ocean in that connection. And again, looking at ongoing developments under the World Health Organization, we have ongoing negotiations on a new pandemic treaty. And why the marine environment has not featured prominently, we do know from the past COVID-19 pandemic that, for instance, marine genetic resources were crucial for developing COVID tests. And I think the whole understanding of One Health, the full integration of from biodiversity research to bioinnovation to health protection, preparedness and responses really needs to be taken into account in that context and to develop regimes that really speak to each other, complement each other and avoid negative impacts on one another. And a lot of what's happening across all these regimes should really influence the choices and the support that will be provided by the UN Decade for Ocean Science and the UN Decade for Ecosystem Restoration. So my recommendation on the basis of this quick snap analysis of how fast evolving has been the international global landscape of relevance is that there is merit in looking both at the ecosystem approach, which has been mentioned before, particularly how it has been defined over time by the 196 parties to the Convention on Biological Diversity, and the human rights approach, and really that sense of interdependence of all our human rights and the connectivity across ecosystems to help us think through how each regime contributes to both SDG 14, but also to realize SDG synergies. And what that means is that we can think about how to use existing international law for policy coherence. The opportunities are there once we apply that lens of looking at ecosystem health and human well-being and their interactions, and therefore realizing SDG 17, 14. But equally, I think once we rely on international human rights law, we have very specific benchmarks of conduct for states, but also for business in the context of the blue economy, to really avoid leaving anyone behind, to really think about the needs of the most vulnerable, to really ensure participation in decision making, which is again, another of the SDG focused also on the international level. And fundamentally, we have clearer guidance around the priorities that should be set for funding, be that ocean research funding or climate funding. And so perhaps the last point that I wish to share with you is that in our own experience with the One Ocean Hub, in both looking at those developments trying to contribute to governance change, we have also realized that the change we need, the transformation, needs to come as early on as possible, at the point of producing the knowledge base on which decisions are made in all these fora internationally, but also at the national level, and really thinking about ways in which transformative science in terms of co-developed science between the global north and the global south, looking very specifically for what went wrong in previous scientific operation, for those power asymmetries, and the integration of other knowledge systems, be that those of indigenous peoples, small-scale fishers, children and women, how we need to change science and scientific practices so that the evidence we co-produce then brings a whole more integrated understanding to all these fora we have discussed. And so I think there is an important point maybe for, again, climate finance and ocean finance to try and take a step back and expect colleagues in development to come with solutions and rather give the time and opportunities to develop fair platforms for co-developing solutions together at the research stage and contribute to governance in that way. So I'll stop there and hope while quick, it was all quite clear.
It was excellent, Elisa, and very grateful for your intervention. Not often we have this overview of the landscape of international processes as they relate to a specific goal. And I think you did a great job of providing us with that and highlighting recent developments as they relate to the oceans and the need for the different processes to the communities to engage with each other and to manage various synergies and trade-offs. Okay, so I'd just like to thank all of the panelists for their excellent interventions and presentations. There's been a lot of questions in the Q&A. I don't know if we have much time to go through them.
Well, Greg, I'll pop in for just a moment to say that we've answered quite a few of them, knowing that we were running over. Some of our some of our panelists have gone and answered directly questions that were asked of them. I would ask for those of our panelists still with us, if you don't mind reactivating your video for a moment. There are still a few questions. And what I would say is, if you don't mind us going over a few minutes before we do a quick wrap up, there are, for instance, I'm going to sort of just jump, let's take a look. All of our panelists have access to the Q&A. If you haven't already, if you might want to scroll through and take a quick look and put your hand up if you'd like to answer one. In the meantime, I'm going to, so one of them, for instance, is, I don't know if anyone can answer this, how is data on SDGs 13 and 14 gathered for input on specifically target 16.7, but that's pretty specific. So I don't know if anybody can address that. So we'll pass that on that for now, unless somebody wants to just jump in. There were some specific questions.
There's a more general question there, I think, about how data from different processes can be used in a specific process. So how, you know, information relevant to poverty can be brought into climate negotiations, for example. So I think it's a good question. It's an important one.
While you are thinking about that, Charles, there were some questions asked at the very end by Sam Majid, you know, that might be more in sort of your area. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, thanks. I have tried to respond to a couple of questions live, but I think one participant asked about corporation using NBS and probably at the cost of indigenous people and the local communities. I just wanted to clarify that I think in this context, everything that people call NBS is not necessarily NBS. So, but it's an open concept which people can claim to use for anything. One of the fear, in fact, that's why ICN have developed the standards is to try to provide the global community about the quality of nature-based solutions. And we'll be putting the standards online, digitizing them so that people can start screening their projects and actions against the standards and criteria. But at the same time, I mean, you can also control the concept, right? It's like what we are saying here, sustainable development. Who knows what is in there? So, I think the community is aware of those risks and how greenwashing can be. So I think recently there's an ongoing negotiation and consultation by UNEP, on nature-based solutions, additional criteria and how we really qualify those, et cetera. So there might be opportunity to continue working on the quality NBS interventions and action for climate and biodiversity. One comment on the data. I think there was another question actually. How do we consider contribution of local NGOs generally in this SDG measurements process? I think one contribution I wanted to have is most of these are also recorded at national level and subnational level through different mechanisms at national level. There's a national level mechanism of tracking the data and the changes that happens across the SDGs. And so those who have those questions, to be good to factor contacting the national level authorities, because that's the best way to track and capture your action at whatever level in this process. Over.
Thank you, Charles. There's a question or a statement made that maybe Oliver and Frederick can comment on. You know, it says about desalination and how it's harming coastal areas, and is it possible to be using hydropower or other renewables for desalination rather than other forms of power? And I wonder if maybe Oliver might comment on whether or not any of the ocean technology companies are using, ocean power for desalination rather than fossil fuels. And Frederick, maybe you can jump in afterwards and just talk about your experience with that problem, if any.
Very happy to answer that, Charles. The short answer is yes. There are some wave energy pilot projects which have looked at using wave energy to power desalinization plants. That could also be linked to tidal energy power plants as well. The benefit being obviously is that in a lot of these areas where there is the need for additional clean water production, there are good wave and tidal energy climates. So actually it can be a very good mix of the two together. And especially if you then start looking at the cost and expense and the wider climate impact of importing large amounts of water from other countries overseas.
Thank you. Frederick, any thoughts on your part about this desalination problem?
We haven't been working too much, or I don't have too much experience with it, but of course the most important for nature, it's important that you don't have technologies that in areas that will provide stress on the biodiversity of both species and habitats. So you need to map out areas where this can be done in a reasonable way in order to keep it sustainable. Of course, the access to clean water is absolutely crucial for all of us. So, but when you don't need the solution or the technology and solutions there to increase also the nature crisis in order to solve it. So it's more about, again, mapping, getting the science that we need for the coastal zones also, making sure that the ecosystems are intact and kept healthy so that the total amount of stress in an area will not be too much for the ecosystems and thereby also the coastal communities.
Thank you, Frederick. Oliver, you want to make one more quick comment before we move on to the final question?
Yeah, I just wanted to come in very quickly on Frederick's point there, you know, about sustainable use of oceans and, you know, not negatively impacting biodiversity. It is really, you know, at the crux of a lot of things that I was pointing out earlier, you know, around, you know, concern or questions around, you know, if you're going to put renewable energy technologies into the oceans and that helps to offset, you know, fossil fuel production, say to power desalinization projects, actually, you know, where it's one of the things that we're going to have to tackle from a bigger perspective is where does that balance point come in terms of, you know, preventing development in the oceans or enabling, you know, sustainable development in the oceans versus additional fossil fuel production and utilization.
Thank you, Oliver. I appreciate that. You know, Gustav, can I ask you perhaps to answer one question, at least address one question? The very last one in the Q&A is, how does participation of civil society and the private sector contribute to the execution of Sustainable Development Goals 13 and 14? And as you are a civil society participation expert, maybe just give a few words on that.
Well, yes, it's a very large question, of course, but without civil society and the private sector and or the NGO community globally and nationally, we will not be able to implement any of the SDGs. And I'm very happy, having listened to all the contributors here today, talking about new and innovative ways of making collaboration happening. I'm especially intrigued by what was said about research and transformative science, and several of you have mentioned that. But, you know, implementing the SDGs, and especially in relationship to the treaty areas we've talked about, is a challenge because, unfortunately, as I've been looking into the maritime elements of the UN, UNCLOS and the other parts, they are not the most open to civil society. Maybe it's because they've been allowed to live alone for so long without the inherent and strong input from civil society. But, I mean, without us, there will be no change. So without us, meaning without civil society and partnerships, there will be no change. And as I tried to say in my introductory stage, we have, the civil society has been adamant at keeping the issues on the agenda. And the some of you have mentioned the plastics issues that is now being negotiated in a couple of days in Paris, the second round. Had it not been for civil society keeping the plastic issue on the agenda, I don't think this would have happened. And you can go through the UN history in so many ways that you can see civil society together with business and together with research. We've been adamant at letting the governments not forget these issues. And then going from there to the complexities of implementation is another challenge we have to face because fortunately or unfortunately, the SDGs demand a lot of expertise from all actors in implementation, and I'm not sure all NGOs are up to that. We have to talk about participation and transparency, but we also have to understand what it means to be part of the ocean or the ocean issues or the infrastructure issues or nature-based solutions issues. We need to do that, so that's a challenge we need to take. But without us, nothing happens.
Thank you. Thank you, Jan Gustav. Lisa, did you want to say one very quick thing, or you, sorry, you put your hand down?
Yes, no, maybe just very quickly, because I saw I answered a similar question in the Q&A section. I just wanted to mention also from the governance perspective, we see all these private initiatives with private actors, members from civil society who come up with voluntary standards, voluntary reporting initiatives. And while, you know, the actual impact of such initiatives might be less than we want them to be, I think it does really create this extended sense of responsibility across actors, which is actually also encouraging others to join such forces. So that's just to quickly add from this perspective.
Thank you very much. Well, I think I'm going to now have to say we're
sorry, Charles, I might just jump in. With a question for Marjo and Eliza, because okay. I thought it was quite interesting in the Q&A. A comment from Joseph Alumu, who said that for many countries in the Global South, the most urgent goal is, you know, related to poverty, tackling poverty, and that climate change, though important, appears not to be a pressing concern. I think that's a fundamental issue. You see it in the current zero draft of the political declaration, this lack of balancing of poverty and climate issues. And if anyone could speak to that, that would be helpful. And there was also a question there for Lisa about, we have many initiatives at international level, but how does this appear to groups in the Global South, and how do we make it work for them in a better way? I think they were very good questions.
Yeah, shall I try and respond to the last one? Yeah, I think one point I wanted to make in the presentation but ran out of time is that aspect of human rights, and particularly the human right to science, which is becoming clearer in content recently, really helps to understand those questions about lack of equity between global north and global south, and what it means for states, and particularly developed states, not to fulfill their obligations of technological, financial, and capacity building solidarity in terms of then human rights of their own populations, but also populations in other states. And I think more and more there is an awareness, and I think we see it, for instance, reflected to some extent in the new BBNJ agreement, and I hope it'll be reflected in the plastics treaty and the pandemic treaty, about the need for international institutions to really look into the barriers, the equity barriers for Global South decision makers, researchers, and stakeholders in not being able to contribute both to the knowledge base and the decisions relating to realizing multiple sustainable SDGs as a precondition for actually the effectiveness of whole new regimes that we're trying to create. So I think that there is a turning point in understanding and new innovations in how we develop the treaties and the institutions, including with participation, and I think more iterative thinking around keeping learning around what the equity issues are and finding responses that are really calibrated to the needs as identified and self-identified by countries and stakeholders in the Global South. So I think there is some movement. I mean, it's still small, but I think participation and engagement with those new processes can help making that a new practice that can be transformative.
Thank you so much for that. We have one more comment coming. Go ahead.
Yes, just very briefly. I know we're almost out of time here, but I just wanted to add something on the issue about poverty and SDG 14 and 13. And I think absolutely, I mean, poverty is a priority that we need to address before we can really move on to do anything else. And I do think it is a fundamental priority of environmental conservation, for example, to contribute to local livelihoods to make sure that there are local benefits. Similarly with blue economies, they can only be successful if we actually address these fundamental issues, and what the solutions are often very context specific, but and something that needs to be co-designed with the communities. But I think it is an absolute priority.
Thank you for that intervention. Sorry, I was muted there. Now, we do have to wrap up, but please hang in there for just a moment. We have some final comments from Stakeholder Forum Director Irina Zubcevic, And I'll quickly introduce her and then hand over the floor. Before joining SF in August 2022, Irena worked for over 20 years in the area of sustainable development, both as part of the Croatian Foreign Service from 1993 to 2007 and at the United Nations Secretariat from 2008 to July 2022, where she contributed to several reports and papers in the area of sustainable development. Irena and her team supported the High-Level Political Forum on Sustainable Development since its inception, and she also supported countries preparing their voluntary national reviews since their beginning in 2016. In her work, Irena engaged with stakeholders of all kinds, from governments to civil society, business and academia, facilitating their participation in the HLPF and other intergovernmental processes. Irena, I'll give the floor over to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Charles, for this introduction, and good morning, good afternoon, good evening to all. Thank you very much to all the presenters and also to your great questions. It was a very exciting webinar for me, and as always, I have learned a lot. And this is really showing because these SDGs are usually they are just environmental SDGs, and sometimes they are taken into account and sometimes they are not. And this is something which really shows how it is important that these SDGs are always taken into account, and how important it is that all the SDGs are indivisible and they have to be implemented together. And we have heard about that a lot because we have seen how these two SDGs are linked to other SDGs, and how important it is to implement them together. So we are very excited to hear all of that, because in the statement for the SDG summit, and Jan Gustav at the beginning told us that the one thing that for the SDG summit we need is urgency, and we are trying to also from our side encourage this urgency, but also this urgency means that we have to implement all the goals as indivisible, because they span the whole activity of human life. I won't be long, because we are having one more SDG, and then we are going to have a more substantive wrap up, and also the way forward that we see, and how we can contribute with this wealth of SDGs that we have had to the SDG summit and beyond. So I would just like to thank everybody on this webinar, the presenters and the participants, but above all, the team from the stakeholder forum who has put this webinar together, who has researched to find this great speaker, so that we have again a successful webinar. The next webinar, as you will hear from Charles, will be at the end of June, and we will address the two remaining goals, that is goal 15 and 16, and then we will have a further activity to look about. Very much, and over to you, Charles.
Thank you very much, Irena. I'll just be very brief. You now see on your screen, I believe, what we will be doing next time around. I'll just make sure that it is there. If the screen is being shared, I think it is. Mm-hmm. Thank you all very much for joining us. In particular, thank you to David Horan, David O'Connor, and Jan Gustav Stundenes for making this event possible by bringing our speakers in, and especially to our expert panel for delivering today's rich and thoughtful content from time zones around the world, but in particular for your recommendations. You know, that's really the sort of thing that we find so essential from our team of panelists. Now, as mentioned earlier, the webinar has been recorded. That recording will be posted as a video and also an audio podcast on the Stakeholder Forum website very soon. You'll get a link, you'll get an email, I should say, from the Zoom platform tomorrow with a link to that. So you'll be able to see that in all the presentations. So everything you've seen today, you'll have access to again. So in closing, thank you for joining us. As you see, we're having one more event. We'll let you know in the next week or so which of those two dates it will be. In the meantime, thank you so much for joining us. Safety to everybody and good health. And we'll see you next time. Thank you.